Chapter 20. Ananda Mayi, the Blissful Mother. My first impression of the Blissful Mother was perhaps the most favourable. Entering the small meeting hall of the ashram, where 15 or 20 people squatted circle-wise on the floor, I saw in the centre of the group a queenly figure in white, who I at once knew must be Ananda Mayi. Either because of the way in which she wore her hair in a topknot, or because of her simple dignity of demeanour, her poise, and the smile that played faintly about her lips. Despite her femininity, she at once struck me as being strangely Buddha-like in appearance. At the same time, I became aware that an intense peace, purity, and coolness, of a quality such as I had never before experienced, was not only pervading the room, but, as it were, blowing from her like a delicate fresh breeze. As Panditji, Sudhir, and I took our seats, a few heads were turned in our direction, but our coming disturbed the tranquillity of the place no more and no longer than the dropping of 3 small pebbles ruffles the still surface of a pool. This was perhaps fortunate, as it gave me time to take in the scene more fully than might otherwise have been possible. A long-bearded monk, seated opposite Ananda Mayi, was reading aloud from what appeared to be a sacred book. Every now and then the Blissful Mother would interpose a few words of comment. Her voice, which came as though from a great distance, was so low that in their eagerness not to miss a single word, the listening semicircle was bent forward with an expression of concentrated attention. Occasionally, Ananda Mayi concluded her comments with a delicate ripple of laughter, the effect of which seemed to spread in ever-widening circles through the audience in the form of a profound satisfaction. As both reading and exposition were in Bengali, which I did not understand, my attention soon wandered. After a few moments, I noticed that a woman in a white sari kept turning round and regarding me with a mild, cow-like curiosity. From the lightness of her complexion, I judged her to be either a Bengali or a Kashmiri, probably the latter. At 12 o'clock, exactly half an hour after our arrival, the long-bearded monk closed his book. Some kind of devotional song was sung, and the meeting was over. People rose stiffly to their feet. Panditji led me forward to Ananda Mayi, who alone had remained seated. In response to my salutations, which I made with folded hands, she inclined her head with a gracious smile. I noticed that her face, which from a distance had seemed beautiful, was deeply lined, especially round the eyes. There was an unpleasing squareness about her nose and chin. Yet, despite these defects of feature, the mother's expression, indeed her whole appearance, was one of indescribable charm. After Panditji, with the greatest deference, had exchanged a few words with her, and she had nodded queenly assent to some suggestion of his, we left her to go and seek our lunch. This we found half a mile up the road, in the house of Panditji's brother-in-law, who had not been expecting us. A bald-headed, westernized Bengali in European dress. He was, I subsequently learned, the son of Dr. Gyan Endranath Chakravarti, the famous Vice-Chancellor of Lucknow University, and of the still more famous Yashoda Ma, whose name was already familiar to me as the guru of the English Vaishnava Ronald Nixon, better known as Sri Krishna Prem. Despite the gentle cordiality of his welcome, there was clearly a mixture of hesitancy and restraint in his attitude towards Panditji, and I was hardly astonished when, after regrets for the smallness of the house and the shortage of accommodation had been offered and received, Panditji, Sudhir and I left with well-filled stomachs to seek a lodging elsewhere. Thereafter I saw him only once or twice, for he never went to Anandamayi's ashram, and Panditji hardly ever visited him. Nevertheless, during our stay at Kishanganj, I was able to learn from him much about his parents, both of whom were reputed to have been great yogis, his father, in fact, having been his mother's guru. From my correspondence with Sri Krishna Prem, I already knew that Yashoda Ma had been a Vaishnava of the Bengal school of Sri Chaitanya, to which Anandamayi also in a sense belonged. It was early afternoon when we walked back towards the ashram, and the fine dust on either side of the road glared so intensely white in the blazing sun that our eyes ached. Despite his umbrella, Panditji's face shone with perspiration, which dripped in great beads from the straw-coloured ends of his heavy white moustache, while the network of purple veins stood out grossly on his scarlet nose, cheeks and forehead. His energy was undiminished, however, and though his breath was coming a little wheezingly, he insisted on turning in at the gate and stalking up the drive with every bungalow we passed to inquire if there were rooms to let. What the caretakers or the startled European couple whose afternoon siesta Panditji rudely broke in upon with his rappings and bangings thought of the strangely assorted trio on their doorsteps, I do not know. But Panditji's forehead was of brass. With an air of lordly condescension, he demanded to know who the owners were and whether they were in residence, whether the place was to let or for sale, as if he had come on purpose to buy it and had the money ready in his pocket. After we had knocked in vain at nearly a dozen doors, the caretaker of a rambling whitewashed building, apparently deserted, said that if we could find a tent, he would allow us to pitch it in a large mango garden which stood on the other side of the road between Anandamayi's ashram and the brother-in-law's bungalow. This concession was due to the fact that, having learned from a neighbour the owner's name and that he was away, Panditji had represented himself to the caretaker as an old friend of the family. After the success of this ruse, to discover a tent was by no means beyond the crafty old scholar's resources, and by the time the sun had declined, the west reddened and the air cooled, our canvas home had been put up among the mango trees. The last golden lights of day struggled through the rich green foliage. While Sudhir collected sticks and blew upon the smoky fire, Panditji's squint-eyed servant fetched water from the canal. Panditji, now in a fine humour, waxed eloquent to me on the advantages of living in the midst of nature and satisfying one's hunger with fruits and nuts like the sages of old. As he thus discoursed, his hands were busy opening the tins of jam, butter, biscuits, pineapple chunks, and chicken that he had purchased in the bazaar. Devotional meetings were held twice daily at the Sri 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 Anandamayi Ashram, and since we had come to Kishanganj for the sole purpose of meeting the Blissful Mother, we were naturally regular in attendance. These meetings invariably took place in the hall where I had first seen her, a rectangular room that occupied the greater part of the ground floor and was capable of accommodating nearly 100 people. To me, the morning sessions, lasting from 10 till 12, were the less interesting. Not more than a dozen or 15 disciples and devotees attended, and though they opened and closed with devotional songs, most of the time was occupied, as it had been on the morning of our arrival, with readings from a Bengali religious book by the same long-bearded ascetic, supplemented by occasional low-toned comments from Anandamayi. A skinny youth with a crane neck, prominent Adam's apple, and long black hair was writing down, I soon noticed, every word she spoke. I also noticed, on the occasions when my attention wandered from the irregular semicircle on the floor to the four white walls of the room, that most of the life-sized framed photographs that hung there were of Annadamai, and that while in some of them she had an expression of supernatural dignity, in others she displayed an archness, almost a coquettishness, of expression which I felt rather inappropriate. In yet another, dishevelled hair fell across the laughing face of a wild woman. Evidently the mother, or Ma in Bengali, as the devotees always called her, was a creature of many moods. The two or three pictures that were not hers included a plump, youthful Krishna, with dusky blue complexion and peacock's feather in his thick, wavy hair, and Sri Chaitanya in ecstasy. From these wanderings, my attention would often be recalled only by the light tapping of small hand drums by the crane-necked youth that preluded the closing song. Prasad, or sacramental food, would then be distributed. This had been placed in front of Annadamai on a tray at the beginning of the proceedings. As it could not be considered prasad till she had partaken of it, her personal attendant, an untidy Bengali young woman, lifted two or three sweets to her mouth, for we had not been at Kishanganj for many days before Panditji explained to me, with an air of great solemnity, that for a number of years Annadamai had neither fed nor washed herself with her own hands. Usually, after merely touching her lips, the sweets would fall to the ground, where they would be scrambled for by the more enthusiastic devotees. Western poets have familiarized us with the idea that each of the four seasons has its own prevailing mood. Indian aesthetics attributes a mood to every period of the day and night. And the ragas, or melodic themes of Indian music, which are classified in accordance with a similar scheme, may be played only at the particular hour that matches the prevailing mood. Whether for this reason, or because of the greater press of devotees, or the suffocatingly close atmosphere in the crowded room, or the heady perfume of flowers that opened only at night, drifting in from the garden, the evening sessions, which lasted from 4 o'clock until 8 or 9, were not only more interesting than those of the morning, but quite different in character. If the prevailing mood of the morning programmes was peace, that of the evening ones was excitement. Reading and exposition were forgotten, the whole period being given up to Hindi, Bengali and Sanskrit devotional songs. These were sung to the accompaniment of a harmonium, now to the disgust of purists the mainstay of Indian amateur orchestras, a brace of small hand drums and several pairs of diminutive but nerve-tingling cymbals. Most of the songs, or bhajans as they are called, had the same subject as the photographs on the wall, Annadamai. Only a few celebrated the praises of Rama, Krishna and other divinities. Quite clearly the mother had become, in her own lifetime, the centre of a minor cult, a phenomenon by no means unusual in India. Though I have described them as devotional songs, practically all the bhajans that the devotees sang with such full-throated fervour every evening were in fact little more than strings of names and epithets sung over and over again, one repetition by a soloist alternating with one by the whole congregation in chorus, a little more rapidly each time, and with gradually mounting enthusiasm for at least 15 or 20 minutes at a stretch, sometimes for more than an hour, depending on the degree of fervour the soloist was able to evoke in the congregation, and the congregation in the soloist. One of the bhajans addressed to Annadamai consisted of the single word Ma, repeated a dozen times. Ma, 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 ma. Ma, ma, ma. This was a great favourite among the inner circle of disciples. The crane-necked youth, who at the same time officiated at the harmonium, would sing it with passionate abandon, head flung back, body swaying and jerking violently, eyes either tightly closed or fixed beseechingly on Anandamayi, and Adam's apple bobbing vigorously up and down. To me, the spectacle of grown men and women singing ma, 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 like so many kittens crying for their mother, was a gross caricature of religious devotion, and I was not astonished when, later on, I learned that several of the younger male members of Anandamayi's entourage had lost their mothers at an early age. Since I had read books on Bengal Vaishnavism, besides visiting the famous Gaudiya Math, headquarters of the movement in Calcutta, it was not long before the aim and the techniques of these bhajan sessions became clear. According to the tenets of this school, the highest attitude which the devotee can adopt towards Krishna, for them the chief divine incarnation, is that of the forsaken mistress towards her beloved. This attitude is exemplified in the highest degree by Radha, the cowgirl of Vrindavan, whose illicit amour with the youthful Krishna is the central theme of the vast theological and devotional literature of Bengal Vaishnavism, as well as by the more historical Sri Chaitanya or Gauranga, the 16th century Bengali founder, or rather inspirer, of the movement, to whom the introduction of public singing of the divine names by large numbers of people is attributed. As among certain Christian revivalist movements in the West, tears, horripilation, and swoons are regarded as evidence that the degree of emotional exaltation requisite to the manifestation of the divine grace in the form of a vision, tactile experience, or audition object of devotion, in this case Krishna, has been attained. Music being the most powerful excitant of the emotions, and the special psychological effects produced by the different melodic themes, rhythms, and musical instruments, having been for ages past well understood in India, it was natural that for devotees of the type that gathered round Anandamayi, the singing of bhajans should be the central spiritual exercise and principal means of approach to the divine. Probably because of the fact that the congregation was, by Bengal Vaishnava standards, small, and the evening bhajan sessions short, the mounting devotional fervour and excitement of the devotees always fell a little short of that climax of uncontrollable emotion, of absolute abandon and self-forgetfulness, towards which they were unconsciously working. Even so, the atmosphere of the room was frequently so highly charged that its stepping up by a single degree, one felt, would be sufficient to sweep the whole congregation off its feet. This was the case particularly when Anandamayi sang, which was neither often nor without much entreaty. Not that her style of singing was at all emotional. High, clear, not very strong, and seeming to come not only from the depths of her being, but from a great distance, her voice would rise and fall, now very slowly, now a little more quickly. As in alternation with the congregation, she sang over and over again the words Sitaram, Sitaram. Her own smiling freedom from any trace of excitement, contrasting in the most striking manner with the convulsive movements and agonized expressions of her disciples. One Sunday evening, however, when the congregation was a little larger and more susceptible, or perhaps the weather a little warmer than usual, the cunningly contrived sequence of melodic themes, the gradually rising tempo, the incessant clapping of hands and swaying of bodies in time with the furious tapping and banging of the drums, and above all the ringing, high-pitched tintinnabulation of the cymbals, in the end so rapid as to form one continuous stream of delirium-inducing sound, succeeded in working up the emotions of the devotees almost to the desired point of release. Another fraction of a degree higher, and all restraint would be down. Abruptly, but without haste, Ananda Mayi rose to her feet. The mere thought that she was about to dance precipitated the long-desired climax. Screaming, sobbing, blinded by tears, the devotees leaped to their feet and began wildly gyrating round the room, most of them prancing like madmen and flinging their arms into the air with loud shrieks. Though the bhajans, many of which I liked and enjoyed, had pleasantly stimulated my own feelings, I now sat petrified, not only untouched by the surrounding hysteria, but with a sense of complete isolation from the type of religion it represented. A stout, blue-turbaned Sikh with a noble white beard, utterly overcome by his feelings, staggered round the room, uttering shriek after piercing shriek, collapsed, rolled over and over on the ground, biting the carpet and foaming at the mouth, and eventually lay sobbing and quivering in the middle of the room. Ananda Mayi, who all this time had remained motionless, with both arms slightly raised, now quietly resumed her seat. Gradually the excitement subsided. The last sobs and groans died away. Trembling and in a state of exhaustion, the devotees sank to the floor and began mopping the perspiration from their brows. After a few minutes, the harmonium began preluding the closing bhajan. Wits were collected, and on a more subdued note, the proceedings came to an end. A person more out of place in these perfervidly devotional surroundings than the rationalist Jawaharlal Nehru could hardly be imagined. But not long afterwards he was induced to pay the ashram a visit. The idea originated with Panditji, who claimed to have been Nehru's tutor, and Ananda Mayi gave her consent. At the old man's insistence, the rather protracted negotiations that preceded the visit were kept a closely guarded secret. And apart from the blissful mother herself, no one in the ashram knew anything about the matter until the last moment, a circumstance that occasioned much angry heart-burning among the younger members of the inner circle, who considered themselves entitled to a share in all councils. Nehru was then holidaying in Mussoorie at a house belonging to one of his sisters, and in a few days' time was due to return to New Delhi for talks with the Viceroy, Lord Mountbatten, regarding the forthcoming transfer of power from His Majesty's government to the Indian National Congress. Panditji's plan was that on his way down to Dehradun, Nehru should stop at the ashram for half an hour's talk with Ananda Mayi. In the interests of secrecy, no written invitation was sent. Instead, telephone calls were made to Mussoorie from a public call box in the bazaar, and after unsuccessful attempts to get through, preliminary skirmishes with secretaries, and inconclusive replies from aides, the great national leader was personally contacted, the invitation conveyed with all the tact and diplomacy at Panditji's command, and the invitation accepted. And Panditji enabled to emerge from the telephone booth, where he had stood for more than an hour, his face radiant with satisfaction and triumph. At 11 o'clock one morning in the first half of June, therefore, a small motorcade drew up at the ashram gate. Panditji, who had been expectantly hovering there for nearly an hour, at once constituting himself master of ceremonies, introduced me to Nehru. We silently saluted each other with folded hands. Panditji, who with his voluminous Bengali-style shawl, draped toga-like under one arm and across the opposite shoulder, had the air of a Roman senator receiving the emperor at his country seat, then conducted his former pupil into the hall, where Ananda Mayi was waiting to receive him. Behind follows Nehru's daughter, Indira, a slim youngish woman wearing a crimson sari and very high-heeled shoes, the redoubtable Sardar Vallabhai Patel, and members of the staff. though the crane-necked youth and others belonging to the inner group had not been let into the secret until almost the last moment, they certainly had no intention of allowing themselves to be any longer excluded from the proceedings. Nehru had therefore to sit through half an hour's bhajan. Since I was seated on his left, this gave me an excellent opportunity of surreptitiously studying him. He sat, elbows on knees, with back bent, shoulders hunched, and eyes fixed on the ground. His pale face wore an expression of intense weariness, strain, and anxiety. Not once during that half hour did he show by so much as an eyelid's flicker that he was paying the slightest attention to the bhajan. In fact, he appeared completely abstracted from his surroundings. Patel, who was almost directly opposite me, sat massively erect, no less immobile than Nehru, gazing into space with an expression of monumental gravity that was almost gloom. As soon as the bhajan was over, Nehru had a short private talk with Anandamayi in her room, after which the motorcade resumed its journey. Panditji, who was one of the few ashramites present, told me that Nehru had asked Anandamayi how to obtain peace of mind, and that she had replied, "Rest within." The visit had not really been a success. Nehru had given no indication of being impressed by Anandamayi to the degree that Panditji had hoped he would be. But this by no means discouraged the sanguine old man, who, after generalizing about the extreme subtlety of spiritual influences and how they worked most powerfully when least perceptible, was soon happily discoursing in a way which suggested his brain was busy with grandiose schemes in which he and Anandamayi were the powers behind the Congress throne. However little Nehru's visit fulfilled Panditji's larger expectations, it certainly had the advantage of momentarily enhancing his prestige at the ashram. This gave him an opportunity for airing his scheme for a Buddhist, or rather Buddhistic, organization under Anandamayi's patronage. The Dharma Vijaya Vahini, or Army of Conquest by Righteousness, as in the language of Ashoka it was to be called, had apparently already been once founded by Panditji and was now to be resuscitated through our joint efforts. Despite flashes of doubt, for although I accepted Panditji's assurances that Anandamayi was personally sympathetic, I could not fail to perceive the indifference of her followers, I plunged with enthusiasm into the work of remodelling the Vahini's prospectus. This entailed lengthy doctrinal discussions with Panditji, who held strongly to the view that Buddhism was of Upanishadic origin. More practical matters, such as the recruitment of workers, were also discussed. This gave me an opportunity to suggest the name of Banerjee, of whom I had already spoken more than once, and with whom I had been in regular correspondence ever since my departure from Calcutta. But so gently did I throw out my line that the fish failed to notice the bait. A day or two later, however, I received a despairing letter from my friend, saying that he had no money and was being treated in an unbearably humiliating fashion by His Holiness. His appeal for help ended, "A friend in need is a friend indeed." Feeling that it was now no time for hints, I frankly proposed to Panditji that Banerjee should be invited to Kishanganj to cooperate with us in our work. Though demurring at first, he eventually gave his consent. Overjoyed, I hurried to the post office and wired my friend 100 rupees for the journey.